sit around and play them sometimes? I guess.
You can bring them tomorrow.
I'll bring them tomorrow.
Then we'll have heart, throat, and solar plexus.
That would be interesting.
That'd be worthwhile.
We'll bell.
That's the party.
That's the party.
What a gorgeous day. Namo Tassa
Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa.
Namo Tassa
Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa.
Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. So I'm kind of torn between two possibilities. I was thinking we could talk about the Eightfold Path tonight, or we could talk about...
Can you hear me?
If I talk too low, will you just put your hand up and wave at me? Or if you have any questions, if I say something you don't understand, please just ask me. So one of the things was the Eightfold Path, because that's like came up yesterday in the sutra that we were doing. And that's such a basic part of Buddhist tradition that I think it's interesting to review it every once in a while, because I think some of you may have heard it, but you don't necessarily know it. Would that be true? So I thought that might be interesting for you. Or we could talk about how in the Buddhist tradition one would start to try to understand how to live in this world with its difficulties and its opposing views and the desire of the heart to do one thing and the mind to do another, and this kind of qualities with that, and how Buddhism regards that whole problem. So I'm not sure really which. So
part
maybe,
two.
Part two?
Second part.
Second part?
Oh, okay.
That's my opinion.
Okay, I'll probably start talking about one of them and then end up talking about the other. Is that all right?
That'd be great.
Sounds good.
But then again, maybe I'll only talk about a piece of one of them. Because the second one, how to live in this world with a sense of satisfaction, without feeling that one is subjected to difficulties and oppositions and forced to be caught in states that are dissatisfactory. It very much involves what they call in Buddhism the First Noble Truth. And the First Noble Truth is part of the first of the Eightfold Path. So there you go. The Eightfold Path starts with something called right view. In order to walk the path to being able to see things as they are, in Buddhism, the first thing you have to do is have right view. Right view means that you understand there is dissatisfactoriness. Now, we all know there's dissatisfactoriness, but mostly we take it as an ego stance, but fortunately I can get out of it. Well, it's all those bastards' faults. You know, we have various ways, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
And my job is going to do good in the world. We have various... Our sense of ourself is in relation to dissatisfactoriness, very often. Would you agree with that or not?
Mm-hmm.
You do?
Yes.
Okay, good. So, excuse me, I have a bit of a throat. In the Buddhist tradition, the first step and the second step of the Eightfold Path are called right view and right thought. And what's interesting about the Eightfold Path is that although you start with right view and right thought, they're basically impossible for you to actually accomplish until you have actually completed all the other stages of the path, and then you end back up in right view and right thought, but with the difference. So you start with a theoretical understanding of right view. The theoretical understanding of right view is basically that there is dissatisfactoriness. That being conjoined with what you don't want is something you can't avoid. If you've ever been in a traffic jam, you know that's true. Is that true? The second one is being separated from you do want is not avoidable either. Sometime or other, you're going to be separated from what you do want. Isn't that true? And to have something that is totally satisfactory and then have it not last is also impermanent. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
You cannot eat dessert forever. Or vegetable soup, or whatever it is you like to imbibe, mentally or physically or emotionally. So that those three things are inherent in the condition of being. What happens to us is that we actually feel that there's some personal vendetta going on when we get into those states. Don't we? We feel either that we are being hard done by, or that we deserve it, we've done something wrong, or that, you know, well, everybody should probably feel this way too, you know, but it's always in relation to I. It's never impersonal. I had this wonderful father-in-law one time. I was married, and I had a father-in-law who was a lovely man, and born and raised Roman Catholic, and very full heart, full kind of passionate heart for devotion, not very happy in any one church, so he tended to go to seances and things, but but his heart was absolutely beautiful. And he had a slipped disc at one time. He had a lot of pain. And he was in the hospital, and he was in emergency, and I got there a little after the rest of the family because I was at where I was working, and the rest of the family was sitting outside in emergency, and being myself, I just plowed right into the emergency and found where he was. And he was lying on a bed, and he was cold, because when you're in pain, you can go into shock. I think you should put that cat out and close the door. So I got some warm blankets, because you know they always have them, and it's just an emergency, he's very busy, and he wasn't somebody who would ask for what he needed, you know. But and I put the warm blankets over him, and he came more back into his body, but then he kept saying over and over again, extreme pain if you've had, you know, a crushed disc or whatever it was he had. He's saying over and over again, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, what did I do? Do you ever feel like that when there's something that happens to you, that you've done something wrong? And you ever sort of cover it up a little bit and try to see, well, everybody else does wrong things too? Do you, any of you? Do you ever do that? You never do that?
Well, I try not to.
That's not the point, though, is it?
Happens, yeah.
Yeah, Terry, you never do it, do you?
Been waiting to hedge my bets for a while.
Oh, yeah.
Today, did you, Michael?
Or you do that. What was so, to me, extraordinary about the Buddha was that he looked at those states and he realized that there was no way that you could manifest in a body which is impermanent, continuously changing, in physical time, without having some state of suffering arise. And he realized that experiences of dissatisfactoriness were inherent in existence. That existence itself was always dissatisfactory. You breathe in, you got to breathe out. You get comfortable, somebody's car alarm goes off. Or a fire engine comes and tries to put out a fire. You know what I'm saying here? That he actually had the power to see directly into that. And when we're in crisis, we don't have that kind of power. It gets very personal. The world gets very small, doesn't it? To somehow cope the best we can is often the most we can hope for. What an extraordinary being. So what he had the insight into is that so long as you are in a form, in the Tibetan tradition they call the body the container, they call, I will use the word consciousness for the moment, the contained. You could use the word soul, contained. There is the container and the contained. There's what, 0.03 grams difference in weight? When you die, did you know that? You're 0.03 grams lighter 1 minute after, 1 second after you die. Did you know that? Have they measured that? Isn't that interesting? That there is that difference somehow. There is the container and the contained. And the relationship between the container and the contained. So long as you are identifying with the container, as you know about bodies, cars, houses, there's continuous upkeep. You have noticed that when you live in a house, you have to do dishes, sweep floors, change the sheets. You've noticed that, haven't you? It's continuous. You live in a body, you have to go to the bathroom, you have to brush your teeth, you have to brush, right? Bathe. Put something on, take something off. So continuous. Continuous upkeep. And the physical body too, you have to continuously eat to keep it nourished, you have to exercise to keep it fit, and so forth and so forth. Sleep. There's this continuous upkeep. So the container is continuously impermanent, moving through changes. And you have to continuously maintain it for it to stay healthy. There comes a point where you're unable to do that. So trying to base your happiness on the container is not likely going to be satisfactory. Trying to ignore the container is certainly not going to be satisfactory. Because you have to respect the container. The container gives you the power to manifest in time. In order to be separate, to see, to name, to love, to have children, to make meals, to have a career, to be involved in the world, and then to dissolve again. You need a body. You need to move in time. There are all these desires. Who knows what they are that cause us to be born? At any one point, to try to block off the physical or not pay attention to it is foolhardy and creates great dissatisfactoriness, doesn't it? By the same token, trying to make the body the right weight, the right height, the right skin tone, the right hair color, like all the ads on TV.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to work either, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen many people in the supermarket who look like the cover of Cosmopolitan? Or Esquire? Or what's that men's magazine that has those guys on it?
Playgirl?
Playgirl? Do they have men on it? Shit. I bet some fool them.
Max.
But you don't see people like that. You see people like, you see the supermarkets. You see that in the supermarkets, but you don't see it in the aisles. Do you?
No.
It would be nice to switch that around, wouldn't it? That might be interesting. So you have this physical form, this body, that basically is always needing maintenance. Is that true?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it basically is operating in time. Linear time, past, present, future. And the brain for that body is here. The brain for that body is here. And that body runs on six sense doors. The five senses and the mind, naming mind, door. And what that mind does is has experiences, names, perceives that experience, names it, categorizes it according to like and dislike, and then stores a series of memories that give you the power in the future to say, oh, that's Bonnie, oh, that's Laura, oh, that's Dawn.
Mm.
But that isn't really Bonnie, that isn't really Laura, that isn't really Dawn. It would be much more real if I forgot the name and said, well, who are you? Because you're changing in every moment, aren't you? There is an overall feeling of a you, but that you is continuously vacillating and changing, isn't it? Before you ate dinner, you felt quite different than after you ate dinner, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Now you're a little sleepy. I'll try to tell a bad joke. How's that? So that whole quality of this body and this brain is basically operating in time, and what it does is it continually sees what is present, relates it to the past, and tries to project what will happen with it in the future.
Mm.
Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
Based on what?
Experience.
Past experience.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically like driving by looking in your rearview mirror.
It's already if you're going backwards, right?
It depends. You should look outside windows too, you know. How big is your mirror, you know? How many suitcases are blocking the view, you know? Like, there's a lot of things. Basically. When you're born, before you have a lot of names, you relate more with your body whose brain is here, which is your speech body, called your speech body in Buddhism. Your speech body has three sense doors, which are, you should know this stuff, sight, sound, and mind. Yeah. And it basically works on the sense of radiance, on radiating. It has to do with the emotions, what we call emotions. That's what this body deals with. It doesn't have names. It has felt sense, vibrations that change the sense. Light, sound, the energy feel. And this body has to do with the interaction between the container and the contained. In Theravada Buddhism, they say nama, meaning mind, rupa, and there's a hyphen between the two. The speech body is the hyphen, is the interaction, the play between the two. The communicator, which is a bridge that flows both ways. So when you're looking at something in the body-body world, and you look at it and you relate to it from the past with an emotion from the past, and you bring that emotion up into the present, what you're doing is you're recreating. You can say, oh, last time I felt like this about it. I wonder if it feels like this time. Does that make sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
So that you allow yourself to have a new experience. But we don't do that, do we? We look for a story, and then we use the emotion to justify our story, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Don't we? So you come along, you've heard me give this analogy many, many times. You come along, you're in this body, you want to go out that door, you try to open the door is locked, you're angry because you're impatient, you think the door shouldn't be locked, it's locked, and you kick the door. What good does that do? What good does it do? Any good? Gives you a sore foot. So now the door is locked and you've got a sore foot. And you're still not through it. But you can see that the emotional sense was, I went through that door before, therefore projecting the past into the future. I should be able to go through it now. Mm-hmm. You try to open it, it doesn't open immediately. The speech flow is interrupted desire, anger. And instead of using the anger to say, okay, is there another door, to brighten up your intelligence and look, you kick the door because you're focused on that door. You're not letting that focus go because you know you've been through that door. So based on the past, if it doesn't go according to how you think it should go, anger arises. Is that true? Now this is when you're using the speech body inappropriately. You're trying to make the body different than it is. Right? You're using the energy not to open your field of vibrational awareness to see what else is possible, but you're trying to make it fit into what you thought it should be. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
Who's doing it? Huh? Is somebody else causing you to do that? But will you blame somebody else for locking the door?
Yeah.
Well, isn't that interesting? And will you feel justified in blaming them? And isn't that interesting? That somehow or other the whole world has to fit into my past experience. Isn't that curious? Everyone else is actually just a cardboard cutout. They only become alive when I give them their lines. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that just interesting? Because if somebody else is like that, we'll get really pissed off with them.
You're not being honest with me.
Is that true? So what happens with the speech body is that very often we don't just feel our reaction and decide how we want to use that energy. We get carried by a view in the physical body that we think we have to attain. We don't let go of what we thought we were doing. We don't let ourselves learn something new.
Mm-hmm.
We don't let ourselves have a new understanding. we keep ourselves bounded by our past experiences. Mm. How are you going to learn something new? If you already know what's going to happen, I know I can get out that door, and you can't get through that door. How are you going to learn something new if you can't let go of the door? The energy is there. The speech body is saying, oh, that door didn't open. But if you're still focused on the door, it's just going to become what didn't happen. It's not going to be what else is there. Am I trying to open it the wrong way? You know, 1,000 possibilities that you're not free to explore. Is that true?
Yes.
I know I'm oversimplifying it in some way, but you can see that this is true in your lives, I think. Mm-hmm. That when you are frustrated by something, it gives you the opportunity to get out of this, the dream of the conditioned states of the past, mm-hmm. and bring yourself into the present and say, okay, what can I see for the first time here? Mm-hmm. As soon as you do that, you have moved from ignorance to radiant clarity. As soon as you can do that, you have become radiant. You're radiating possibility. As soon as you do that, many options open. I have been living on the lip of insanity, wanting to know reasons, knocking on the door. It opens. I've been knocking from the inside. Remember that poem?
Mm-hmm.
Rumi. I have been living on the lip of insanity, wanting to know reasons, knocking on the door. It opens. I've been knocking from the inside. I've been here all along. I've been trying to get in and I'm already in. Oh my God. Who knew? But you see, if you think that past, present, future, that timeline is you're going to get somewhere, rather than you are somewhere. Do you see that fine distinction? When you're focusing on the physical body, it's always linear time. When you're operating in the physical body with compassion, whatever you meet, with compassion or with love, whatever you meet in the physical world, either make space for it or find something beautiful in it. That's all she wrote. Anything else you do is going to go explode in your face.
Yeah.
Because the physical world is based on past, present, and future. Isn't it? Nothing arises without cause. The emotional world, the speech body, is your power. How are you going to use the energy? If you're going to use the energy to try to make the physical world different than it is, hey, best of Irish luck. I've told you about Buckminster Fuller telling everybody about his dream, so I'll tell you again, because you know how I love to repeat myself. Mm-hmm. Buckminster Fuller, you know who Buckminster Fuller was. Great hero. Geodesic dome. Right? Designed because of the fascia of the body. How he designed it. Because it's the fascia that holds it together. It's his strength. Same with the body. Buckminster Fuller, his daughter died. His wife, he was brilliant. His wife knew he was brilliant. She was working. They had this beautiful child. He loved his daughter. Because he was working on all these brilliant ideas, because he was such a brilliant guy. And she was supporting him. His daughter got sick. She died. He was devastated. He felt like he was a total failure. know that stuff about suffering? He felt that somehow he wasn't, you know, he wasn't a good father and he hadn't been a good person in his... He felt like he shouldn't be with his wife. He just felt totally. He decided to kill himself. Checked into a hotel. Depressed. Fell asleep. Has a dream. This was a long time ago, so this might outdate some of you. He dreams that he's swimming in the ocean and the Queen Mary is sailing across the ocean. And he swims to the front of the Queen Mary. It was a huge, at the time, a huge, some of you young uns, was a huge liner that was very posh in its day. And he swims to the front of the Queen Mary and he starts pushing on the prow. Does it move?
No.
So he lets go. And he's feeling really, really sad, but he just sort of treads water and the Queen Mary goes past him and he sees the rudder. So he swims over to the rudder and he hooks himself onto the rudder and tilts his body. And does the Queen Mary turn?
Yes.
Oh. And then he woke up, checked out of the hotel, went back to his wife. But as you don't try to change the physical, you take your energy and move it with the way it is going, because nothing arises without cause. You want a certain cause, you use your energy to create that. It is the motives of your being, the energy of your being, that will bring forth the next physical manifestation. It is motive, not action. The Buddha said that over and over and over and over again. It is motive. It is your heart, not the action. Three people can perform the same action, but with different motives, and it will be a different action for each of them. You know that. You know, you watch three people do dishes. With totally different motive, right? But it is your motive that creates your life, not your actions. So the speech body is the body of power, of radiating communication. It's the shaper, it's the sculptor. It's nice to know that, isn't it? And it has basically three ways of manifesting. One is gung-ho, one is forget it, mate, and one is and what they have to learn how to do is balance gung-ho and forget it, mate, without going into a total dream. What you have to do is know how to have the passion and the doubt working together, so that the doubt gets a little yeast from passion. And passion gets a little draft from doubt. And then in between, there is this state of just being in the present, not dulling out or being caught in trying to get something, but being present. When you treat the speech body that way, things work. But it's not enough for things to work for me. What's that spiritual? None of us are free, None of us are free. None of us are free. If one of us is chained, none of us are free.
You heard that one?
Beautiful song. If one of us is chained, none of us are free. It's beautiful, isn't it? Because we don't operate in a void, much as some of us would like to. We are interconnected. We are interactive. You can't eat without killing. If you don't eat, you're killing what's waiting for you to eat inside you. The whole world is continuously eating itself. We are totally interactive. So not only have the power of aspiration, the power of using your speech body well, but then have the question about beyond subject-object identity, what is that? Is there any reality beyond subject-object? Now, isn't that a nice question? I think that's a damn good question. Don't you like that question? God, that's a good one. Isn't that? But to really ask that question and look at how much of your life is in relation to, is there a state that is actually not in relation to, but a totality state. But that doesn't even say it, does it? But is there a state beyond subject-object duality where there is no such thing as suffering? No such thing as chained or free. Is there such a state? That's a good question. That's a question worth focusing on. Not am I safe, but other than I.
Is anything happening?
And that's where you get to this point. The brain is here. Can you see where that is? That's called the mind body. Some people call it the heart body. So this body has six sense doors, and it moves in linear time. The sense body has three sense doors, and it's sort of a globe. You know, when you're depressed, you can't see why you shouldn't be depressed because you're only just going to get depressed again if you get out of it. Is that true? When you're in love, you can't understand why everybody isn't happy. Look at such a beautiful, look at this rain. It's so gorgeous. Go for you guys. I'm singing in the rain. When you're in hate, you can see every reason why you're right and that bastard shouldn't have been born in the first place, and furthermore, their teeth suck. Isn't that true? You just go with the evidence, it just piles up, right? Every emotional state is like a globe. It includes all of the evidence of the why that's right. Isn't that true? Well, think about it. What's your emotions? When you're sad, don't you just fall right into it and remember how sad it is being sad? When you actually have the space to just watch sadness come and go. Very rarely do you have the space. Mostly, it's like days, isn't it? Pull the blinds because I'm enjoying being sad. Is it true? So this the sense of time in this is more like a globe. I always like to think of it as a huge ball of mercury. You know, mercury, you know, makes itself a perfect, or any water, any liquid. Always there's a surface tension. And it's true, emotional states are like that. They do have a surface tension, don't they? So when you're in one, to actually make the effort to remember another is very difficult. But it doesn't actually have an object, it's just the feeling. And you will remember all the various times. But if you actually just turn and look directly at that emotional state, it's just a globe. And this body is infinite. So this is linear time. This is infinite. And this is the dancing flow of different energies that goes between the two. This body is infinite. Can you ever fill your mind? You can focus your mind really tight on one thing, so you refuse to see the spaciousness of it. But you can never fill your mind. Have you ever filled your mind?
Just in your class this week.
He's looking for an apple. Computer. This mind, however, has two characteristics if you're a Buddhist. I don't know if you're not a Buddhist, but if you're a Buddhist, it does too. One of them is called clarity. And the other is called noundness. I mean, verbness. Activity. No fixed. No fixedness. Sometimes translated as emptiness. No fixedness. Clarity, there is a clarity. How, I'm presuming you're looking at me and you actually think you see me. How do you see me? Is there some kind of clarity that you see an image of me that you think is me? Mm-hmm. How does your brain perceive that? Mm-hmm. How do you know you actually see me? But when you actually look, you remember, wasn't that a great weekend with the Fab Four? Remember that weekend with the Fab Four? How many of you were at the weekend with the Fab Four? It was brilliant, wasn't it? Remember when they were talking about the pictures? About the photograph? You know, when you see a movie, sometimes you see a car and it looks like the car wheel is going backward? You know that? You know why it looks like that? Because the camera, the wheel is turning, say the car is going this way, so the wheel is turning this way and the axles are like that, right? And as the wheel is turning, first the axle, one axle is here, and the camera takes a picture when it's there. And then the wheel is turning again, and the camera takes the next picture when the axle is there. And although the wheel is turning this way, the pictures come out with the, you know, this way, right? Because it, did you get that?
Mm-hmm.
So that when you show the movie, because it only takes the picture when the axle is one step back from where it was before, it looks like the wheel is going backward. Because the camera takes the picture slower, right? Not at one revolution, except. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that your mind does that? That you're always taking a picture of events that your mind, you know, you've seen that when you're in shock. Any of you ever been in shock?
Mm-hmm.
Where you get a picture and then a picture and then a picture? Have you ever seen that? I've had that experience.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you have a sight and then you have a hearing and then you have a sight.
Mm-hmm.
Any of you had that experience besides a couple of us? So you know what I'm talking about. Well, the rest of you take our word for that.
Mm-hmm.
There's about five of us here that have put up our hands. Will you accept that? When you are actually, your whole sense of the movie is interrupted. What you see is your eyes seeing something, your eyes seeing the next shot, the eye sending the information to the brain for the next shot, next shot, next shot. Every once in a while an ear one will come in, right? And you get a series of pictures. What happens is that you make up a story connecting all the pictures. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm.
So when you think you're seeing me, you're not. You're seeing a series of pictures and you're filling it in between. Did you know that? In Buddhism, it's called illusion. And you don't negate the illusion. You just know that it's a way of seeing. It isn't necessarily the only way of seeing. It isn't even necessarily true outside of your truth. You've heard all those things about subliminal hearing tapes and all that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
These are true. This is true. This is real. This is how you see. It's a dream. This is how I see. It's a dream. So there are all these pictures going on, and there is a great clarity in the mind that allows all these thousands of pictures to go on and be processed in the film, and the mind is never full. There's this clarity of the screen of your own being, consciousness. In many different movies, you can change your movie in mid-production, can't you? Have you ever done that?
Yeah.
Have you ever been somewhere in a supermarket or something and saw the back of somebody that you thought you knew? Got yourself all ready because it was that guy you were so attracted to when you pull your straps up, you pull your belly in, you hold your breath because maybe you got ate some garlic and you say, all ready to say, oh, hello, and it turns around and it's not him. And the whole movie just falls and you're back. You know, like that. Isn't it? It's just like that. Like one movie and another movie. And you don't even think about it. But isn't that remarkable? That we can flip realities like that? Isn't that remarkable? And the whole emotion changes? Who's in charge?
But you can play with that.
That's exactly what you do in Buddhism. That's exactly what you do. When you know that that's happening, then you start saying, hey, what movie do I want to play? How about loving kindness and compassion?
Mm-hmm.
That's called arising yoga.
Mm-hmm.
We're playing arising yoga all the time, but half the time we're creating these radiant deities that leave a little to be desired. Kicking doors and, you know. But actually, to start saying, no, actually, I wouldn't mind, you know, like I'll practice sainthood just for, 10 minutes. Nothing too much, but say 10 minutes. I'll do 10 minutes. Maybe you'll like it. You are. Did you want to say more?
Well, when I was first interested in changing, that there's a possibility to change some things, this person said, well, in order to be happy, when something happens and you get unhappy, well, then know that that's what's happening. And my interpretation was that you could just change the emotional state to how it should, how you would like to have it, and connect with it, and then you're kind of like blissed out.
You can do that, but it's probably much better to watch the sense of happiness or unhappiness without having to act on it, so that you don't prefer happiness or unhappiness.
Mm-hmm.
Just don't act on it. That would get you further, quicker. That would get you to a state of freedom quicker if you allow yourself to watch the emotions without believing they are you.
Mm-hmm.
Because the emotions are like winds. And they will blow, and if you're not anchored, they'll blow you any direction. If it's anger, you'll blow in the direction of kill that bastard. If it's love, it'll blow in the direction of, oh, I knew you and I were meant to be together. You know, it's just like, they're just winds, they just blow. And when you learn that you are not them, when you, oh, here is love. Oh, how nice to watch it. No, I don't think I'll play, but it's really nice to feel myself.
But you might miss out.
Okay. What might you miss out?
Well,
have a few love affairs first, and then you don't mind missing out. You got your memories. And you don't have the next day.
Ouch.
So that when you actually realize that you are not those emotions and you quit playing them, but you start to actually see, okay, but these emotions have a lot of power.
Yeah.
And what is the power of anger?
Hmm.
What is the power of anger? Have you ever been angry?
Oh, yeah.
What does anger do?
Things get really tight.
Really tight, absolutely. In fact, anger fixates on something, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Fixate on just what's wrong. It's just the way you've got your arms crossed right now. You always cross your arms like that. And I know when you cross your arms like that, I know it's going to happen. Last time you cross your arms like that, when I didn't say you cross your arms like that, I'm going to kill you! Right? Doesn't it? It fixates.
Yeah.
So then you know something. First of all, if you're watching anger, you know, oh, this is anger. It has a lot of power, and it fixates. Okay? I would like to use the power, but I'm going to unfixate it. If you can watch the emotion, you don't miss out at all. No, you get to steer. You get to use those winds for what you actually want. Not just being pushed around. As long as you have to have emotions a certain way, that's still okay, but you're still caught. But when it gets so that the winds of the emotion are like a storm and you're like a really skilled sailor and you can tack and you can turn your sail so that regardless of which the way the wind is blowing, you can go where you want to go. That's skill, isn't it? What are you going to miss out on? First, have as many love affairs and as anger affairs and jealousy affairs and greed affairs as one could possibly want, because they get boring, don't they?
Mm.
Have you found that you need a few more? Some of us need a few more. Every once in a while I play around with it, you know. Been celibate since 1980. Yeah, I don't think so, no. But, you know, like, I mean, I ask. I actually ask. I want to know, you know.
So, Cecily, are you just saying, in other words, that you can experience the emotion without acting on it?
You can.
You don't need to. So you can. I am angry, but I don't need.
No, you
to
don't.
Act.
I am not. I am not angry. I am sitting here.
Yes.
And oh, this
experiencing
is,
anger.
No. This is anger arising in me. How do I want to use it? Well, I don't want it to fixate. Oh, good. She's uncrossed her arms. I say from that, but her bottom button is undone. Okay. I don't want to fixate on the bottom button. Okay. I'm going to fixate on the fact that everybody has buttons somewhere. So I make the focus bigger. Because every one of the emotions has a weakness and a strength. Anger has tremendous power, and its weakness is it fixates. So I start manipulating its fixation, and I have the power, and I can use it whatever way I want. First, you have to have the ability to watch the emotions before you can do that. And that means you have to quit thinking that the physical world is responsible for how you feel. It's not. You're responsible for how you feel. I'm responsible for how I feel. We're all responsible for how we feel. What do we want to do with it?
Mm-hmm.
We all got this incredible richness called a human life. What do we want to do with it?
Mm-hmm.
You want to be pissed off? Great. Life will give you that right.
Yeah.
No, nobody will argue.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be a lover? Be a lover. Yeah.
Could you explain a little bit more about you're talking about the mind and the sixth sense doors and then the speech and emotional body and then you're going down into...
I said body, body, brain.
Body, yeah.
Six sense doors, three sense doors, one.
Okay.
And it's infinite.
What is the clarity with it?
Clarity, it has two characteristics, clarity and emptiness.
Is there still a subject-object distinction when you're down here?
No,
isn't there
it's infinite.
What is down here? I'm seeing
here.
All this, the brain has to be the brain.
This is the brain for the body, this is the brain for speech. Right here. You know how sometimes when you have emotional states, your throat gets tight?
Just a stutter.
Speech. That's the brain for emotional states and motives. This is the brain for, in Buddhist teaching, mind.
Mm.
So if you're Buddhist, you have three brains. Body brain, speech brain, and mind brain. And what you want to do is use the body brain for body purposes, the speech brain for speech purposes, and the mind brain for mind purposes. Then when all three are operating properly, then you can ask decent questions and get decent answers. But are you using the speech brain trying to make the body brain, mm-hmm. or the body brain, you know? And that's what we do, and that's what causes us our problems. So the whole of the Buddhist teaching basically is about those appropriate use of the three types of consciousness or intelligence that we have. There is a part of our being that knows totality, that has never been lost, that recognizes truth. There is that part of our being. Always there. But whether or not we will trust ourselves to be vulnerable to it depends a lot on this one and this one. Then there are people who always wander around going, "All life is one." But they don't pay their taxes. You know, so they're not. It was meant to be. You know? But they're not, you know? And they're not picking up their shoes from in front of the door and somebody's going to trip over them and break their leg. Does that make sense? So like all three, each of us, we have one of the bodies that we're better at. And one we're not so good at.
Mm-hmm.
I bet it would surprise you to know that I have some talent with a speech body. Do you want to go further? Is that good for now?
Wait, you can answer someone else and then come back.
Okay.
What you just said about emptiness, non-fixedness.
It's a verb. Emptiness means verb.
Okay.
Means activity. No fixed identity. Process. It's our brain that makes fixed. Takes pictures.
Okay.
Images.
Okay.
But this is a dance.
So I never thought of it. Because that's something. I mean, a dance is something. I always thought of emptiness as a void or something like that.
Is the wind something? Is the wind something?
Yes. Yeah.
What thing is it? I think the wind
is activity.
I think the wind is more somethinging.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, everything is a wind.
Okay. So this is wind.
No, this is the mind body. It has two characteristics.
clarity.
And emptiness.
And emptiness is activity?
Emptiness is no fixed identity. That's how it's defined. Trying to define it as activity doesn't quite do it. But saying there is no fixed identity is, it has to be described in negation rather than affirmation. Because as soon as there's any kind of affirmation, then there's thinking. I hope not. Yes. Were you going to say something, Ben?
No. But could you go over that? So, sorry.
Yeah, and then I'll be right back.
You said at the beginning that you would get to how it relates to living in the world. Was I mistaken? Or?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, because I'm wondering, say for example, when I'm in the process of this is anger arising, and then I watch the anger, and I used to hang on to anger for years, and now I can hang on to it for 10 minutes, maybe a day, a couple seconds. However, maybe the person I'm having a conflict with, not maybe, but the person I'm having a conflict with is hanging on to the anger for a long time. And I've already gone through my stage, and it's like, okay, well, let's get on with other business at hand, right? So I guess it's just acceptance of where everybody's at.
Basically, and you're right, it is basically acceptance, and when you do accept where everybody is at some point or other, they'll start to realize that you're in a different place.
Mm.
It was such a relief to my family when I was no longer a new convert. when I first met my beloved teacher in Andabodi many years ago, and then I would visit home. It was really hard. My sister used to leave about 5 minutes after I arrived at her place. Both my brother-in-laws told me they'd be happy if I didn't spend much time with their kids. I was a new convert. And I just wanted them to accept me. You understand? Because I had seen the error of my ways. And I had found a path. And I was very humble in my peculiar way, telling them how glad I was that I had found this wonderful teacher.
Hmm.
And I had already, gotten over clinging to those states I was clinging to before. And I understood it. But they just didn't seem to want to accept that. Transcended all that, for quite a while. I really did try to fit in. And they kept trying to fit me out. Until I finally just thought, well, I can't do anything about them, but what I can do is do my own practice, wish them well, and do my own practice.
Mm-hmm.
Just, after a couple of years, they started getting real interested in it. And asking me questions. At one part, every member of my living family started calling themselves Buddhists. That was scary. They were Christians before that. Threatened my identity. Those are big lies and jokes, those last parts, but the thing is that if I know I have gotten over something, then I should have gotten over that I got over it. And I hadn't gotten over that. I was still really happy to tell them that I'd gotten over it. And I had to take one more step where there was nothing to get over.
Mm.
Where there was suffering and the cessation of suffering. and not worry about it, whether it was out there or in here. And just be very content at seeing who was here and how I was going to work in the moment. And then everything I met was my consort. Every circumstance. I mean, I'm still working on that. But that was the idea, that everything I met was exactly what I needed to meet, because this is what I was working with.
It's more of a process than an event.
That's right. And when I actually accepted that and had a more of a sense of humor about myself and my relationship with others, it's interesting how they got interested in me. You don't really seem to be angry about that. You know? So what have you been doing these last few years, you know? Then they start dropping in to visit me in the faraway places I went to. Going to classes. Not because they wanted to become like me, but because they were so they could see that I actually was happier. And they were happy for me first, and then second, they wondered what was making me happier. Because people aren't stupid. All beings desire pleasure. If you start being happier, somebody's going to start saying, "What's she doing?" You know, and the very best guru you will ever find is the world itself. The very best, most profoundly beautiful, honest guru that you could bow to thousands of times is what presents you to you every day, from everything around you. When you actually realize that is when you start paying attention to your own motives. Okay, am I practicing compassion or loving kindness here with the world? No. I'm practicing the wish that they would recognize how spiritual I am. What's their problem? That's what I was doing. Their problem was they'd headed up to here with spirituality and progress from me. You know, they'd been through a few by that time. Point where my mother was afraid to read newspapers, find out what she would read about me next. Enough already. But when I left them alone and just got on about my own business and cared for my own heart, if somebody else is caught in anger, that's a choice. They have as much power as I do. And that was when I think it was reasonable for me to be a teacher. To teach what I had been learning was when I realized that everybody has as much power as me. Even the cat. And it's nice to know that. We all have different circumstances. We all have different intelligence. We have all different emotional balances, don't we? We all have different experiences, different childhoods, different ways of relating. Some of us relate more from the body. Some of us relate more from the mind. Isn't that true? And we all have the same amount of power because we all have that basic understanding in the core of our being that there is something, some state of liberation, whatever you want to call it. And if we look at each other with that knowledge, then we will respect each other. Why should you go the same way someone else goes? Why should you argue if somebody else doesn't go the same way and you're riding in the same car or eating in the same fridge? Why shouldn't you think of that as an opportunity? How much do you want to suffer in your life? There are two ways you work with the world. give it space, or find beauty. That's Buddhism. Is that helpful?
Yes.
Yeah. So, the Eightfold Path, Four Noble Truths. There is dissatisfactoriness, first one. Second one. It has a cause. There is a cause for dissatisfactoriness. Third one. Whatever is causal is impermanent. It has a cessation. Fourth one. There is a way to come to the cessation of being subject to dissatisfactoriness. Isn't that beautiful?
Mm-hmm.
Four Noble Truths, the basis of all the Buddhist teaching. Second part of the Eightfold Path, it's called Right Intention, Right Thought. And it's basically thought free of sensual desire, thought free of ill will, and non-harmful thought. When you are thinking and you see that the thought has sensual desire as the motive, you say, well, that's probably going to cause me pain and suffering, and it's going to cause other people pain and suffering, right? Like the sutra last night. I think I'll try putting that aside. I don't want to. Or ill will, see. Isn't that beautiful sutra last night? So beautiful. Third noble truth, right speech. The third of the Eightfold Path, right speech. There are four types of right speech. You've heard this ad nauseum. You want to hear it again? God, you guys never get bored, do you? First one is usually called non-lying. What the sutras actually say when you read the Buddha, it says, not purposefully omitting or changing something that you know to not have not be true. So purposefully, meaning to mislead. That's what lying is. Meaning to mislead. That's different than some of us use it, isn't it? Second kind of false speech is called non-tale-bearing, and a particular kind of tale-bearing where you demonize someone. Where you go out of your way to make someone appear to be like a demon. Third kind of false speech. The word that is used to describe it in Buddhism is the same as the word for hatchet. Harsh speech, it's often translated. But more than harsh, you use your speech to cut. That's called false speech. Harsh speech. I mean, wrong speech. And the fourth kind, do you know the word pollard? Any of you gardeners? Pollard, P-O-L-L-A-R-D. You know, when you cut off the live branches? You know? Or they used to take the horns off of bulls or castrate them, and that would be called pollarding. It comes from the same word as that. It's actually a Sanskrit word, and it basically means castrating. We call it gossip now, but speech that is deadening, speech that causes deadness of energy. It's usually translated now as gossip, but that's the fourth kind of false speech. Dead speech, gossip. So So those are four kinds of speech that you make effort to not be caught in. Mm-hmm. Pretty nice, aren't they? I think, you know, at one time I tried to practice that for a year. Mm-hmm. You remember in classes in Toronto when I used to talk about that? If you just practice right speech for a year, you find all your neuroses cleared up. I used to say things like that all the time. Adrea put up with me. So those are the four types of speech. And then the next one is called right action. And right action is... is based on... not actions that do not cause death or harm, not killing or harming, actions that are not involved with taking what is not freely given, and actions that are not performing, actions that are not making your pleasure more important than anyone else's pleasure. Kame sumi chachara. Where your pleasure does not cause you to ignore other people's pleasure. Like mugging old ladies or raping two-year-olds or things like that. Do you understand? Where your pleasure is like, just like, you're not important, you're an object. I like to use extremes because that sometimes goes into people's minds better. And basically, the right action, what it does is it causes you to have a greater peacefulness in the three worlds, in the body, speech, and mind. There's a greater sense of ease and peacefulness. You're not looking around to see why everybody does it or collecting evidence about other people because you feel guilty or, you understand? You're not waiting to be caught. It's very important, isn't it? And then the next one is called right effort, and right effort is the same as the four efforts. When you see the possibility of the unwholesome, what? You won't go there. Avoid it. When you are involved in the unwholesome in the present, what do you do?
Drop it.
When you see that you are involved with the wholesome, what do you do?
Turn there.
Hmm?
Go there.
You're already there.
Oh, increase it.
How do you increase it? It's already there. When you see you're involved in the wholesome, what you do is you become conscious of it, you name it, you let yourself be aware in it. You bring more awareness into it. When you see that you're in a kind of a neutral state, neither wholesome nor unwholesome, what do you do? You encourage the wholesome.
Oh, okay.
Those are the four efforts. Right effort. We still have 10 minutes. Okay, right livelihood. Right livelihood is basically right livelihood has to do with the respectful interaction the completion of sila is basically what it's usually talked about as, and it essentially comes down to protecting your state of happiness by treating others as you would, like very much like doing unto others as you would do to yourself. And in its most classic form, it's compared to developing jhana, developing blissful absorption. You know that when you are in love, or you're holding a newborn baby, or you're listening to beautiful music, or you're looking at exquisite light, or just for a moment your heart opens, you know there is this kind of blissful, easeful feeling. That would be the mark of right livelihood. Wherever you are, whatever you are doing, whatever you're engaged in, that would be the balance point of your life. So right livelihood is the result of the completion of the 10 marks of sila. Now we've covered the first four, like not killing and harming, first three, not killing and harming, not stealing, right? Not sensual misconduct. And then we covered the four of the speech. So now the last 10 marks of sila have to do with mind again, and it's basically developing that same blissfulness as first jhana, developing that sense of fairness and openness and interest with all beings, regardless of the circumstance. That would be called right livelihood. That's an interesting one, isn't it? And because I'm trying to rush to finish them, I'm not going to say much more about that. Right mindfulness, then, the next one, is a really interesting one, because with right mindfulness, now you see you have established some kind of clarity of emotion. See, with right livelihood, you know how, regardless of what the circumstance is in the world, and regardless of what your past experience was, you want to be in that state of blissfulness. You would prefer to be a lover. So you've taught yourself how to do that. Right? So then, now you come to this very, very beautiful kind of way of, okay, now that you have some emotion, you have physical balance, you're treating the world with appropriateness, you have emotional balance, you're allowing yourself to be the present in the world under all circumstances, and you can use the winds to develop a state of blissfulness regardless of what's arising. And then, now you're saying, okay, now how do I want to use the mind? Now you want to train your mind to move beyond subject-object duality. So this is where one of my favorite little things that you've heard from me many times comes from. Is that when you practice seeing the wholesome in the unwholesome. When you see something that you don't like, find something you like in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then second, you start practicing when you see the wholesome, find something you dislike in it. Is that good? And then the third one is, see if you can look at something that previously you disliked, and now you found something you look and find like in it. See if you can go back and forth between the like and dislike until you can equally like it or dislike it. And the fourth, okay, now you found something you like and you found something you dislike in it. Now can you go back and forth between those two so that you can do either equally? And the fifth, can you hold both the like and the dislike in the mind at the same time? That is it, can you transcend subject-object duality? Can you go beyond subject? And that is actually a practice. it isn't that you can do it, but it is that there is a state where that is what is occurring. And that's, according to the Buddha, that is called dissolution of boundaries.
So you're actually looking at the dislike and like.
You're holding them together.
Outside of the like and dislike.
Yeah, exactly. Isn't that interesting? And then the final one, right concentration. Now, you can be in a state of bliss and see all the possible permutations of emptiness. Clarity and emptiness. Because you're outside of the boundaries. It's called non-dual wisdom. There. Three bodies and eightfold path.
And we get out our big letters.
We got 3 minutes. You got any questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Kind of whipped through a few tonight, did we?
Coming back to that feeling full concept.
So, when you were talking, what really hit me when you were talking about, I tend to dull out. I just love to dull up, and it really struck me, like when I'm dulling out, I can see quite clearly. All I need to do is get up and do something wholesome. I forget how that related, what the word was, but looking for the wholesome.
Yeah, well, the fourth effort.
Yeah, yeah.
When you're in a neutral state.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. Yeah.
Seed the wholesome.
Because that really related to me, like dulling out, and I'll just get up and do something.
Or you don't even get up. You don't even have to get up. You just have to be present and say, "My God, I'm lucky to have a human birth where I can dull out."
Okay.
You know, immediately practice gratitude for where you are.
Okay.
You just have, it's your motive that matters, not the action. I say that again and again and again. It is the motive that matters, not the action. Not what you do in the world, it is who is doing. Because that's what carries on. 0.03 when you die. That's what is creating the next circumstance. Every moment we're dying. Habituation is reborn. Want to change it? Change it! Mm-hmm. We all have the same amount of power. Is that useful?
Yes.
Yeah. Then you would also say, so every moment we're creating the future.
The Buddha said nothing arises without cause. Then he said whatever is causal is impermanent. So first of all there is bondage, second of all there is liberation. Third of all it's a dance. There is no inherent identity. Clarity and emptiness. He's smiling again. Here comes another hour.
The concept of bloated. Just letting you know that.
Yep. So you notice this. Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Okay. You notice this extremely beautiful gold light in your hearts. And it tingles in your belly. And it spreads up to your shoulders and down through your hips. And down your legs and down your arms and up your head bone. Comes out your hair. Comes out your skin and all your pores. It dances around so there's this big giggle all over your skin. It just comes out and fills this room with this beautiful gold light. fills the house, the city, anyone you want to pray for, just through the whole world, just hit the blast, a blast into the Yukon there, down to where that hurricane is gone, all the beings in the world everywhere. The mice, the whole planet out into space, this beautiful gold light flows, so wherever there is suffering due to ignorance of body, speech, and mind, it's just temporarily assuaged, and you think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. So thank you for your great compassion. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Tomorrow, U.S.